flowing into the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julie Haller, journalist. This article is published under the heading Corporate Media Ignore U.S. Sanctions Driving Starvation Threat in Afghanistan. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As the United States withdrew militarily from Afghanistan in August, U.S. TV news interest in the plight of the country's citizens spiked, often focusing on the horror awaiting women and girls in CNN's Situation Room to argue against withdrawal. 4 months later, as those same citizens have been plunged into a humanitarian crisis due in no small parts to U.S. sanctions, where is the outrage? Experts warned of an impending humanitarian crisis in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal. In recent months, the messages have become more urgent. A UN report warned that combined shocks of drought, conflict, COVID-19, and an economic crisis in Afghanistan have left more than half the population facing a record level of acute hunger. 1 million children are so malnourished, they are at risk of dying in the coming month. Decades of conflict, invasion, and occupation left Afghanistan with a highly precarious economy. In 2019, well before withdrawal, a record 50% of Afghans reported finding it very difficult to get by on their household income. While drought and the COVID-19 pandemic have contributed to the current humanitarian crisis, it is largely driven by the imploding economy. The entire banking system is collapsing, with government employees going unpaid and citizens unable to access their money or receive funds from relatives abroad. As many have pointed out, the Taliban shoulders some blame, having banned women from most paid jobs outside of teaching and healthcare, costing the economy up to 5% of its GDP. But a much bigger driver of the crisis has been the U.S.-led sanctions on the Taliban. The U.S. occupation left Afghanistan dependent on aid for 40% of its GDP and 80% of its budget. After withdrawal, the U.S. froze some $9 billion of the country's central bank reserves, and U.S. and UN sanctions cut off the central bank from the international banking system and drastically limited the aid flowing into the country. Despite pleas from around the globe, even most recently from former U.S. military commanders in Afghanistan and dozens of members of Congress, the Biden administration has made only slight tweaks to its policies, which are ostensibly meant to punish and provide leverage over Taliban, but like other supposedly targeted sanctions, have the effect of putting millions of civilian lives in peril. Since November 1st, well into the worsening crisis, FAIR identified only 37 TV news segments from ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and MSNBC that mentioned humanitarian in the same sentence as Afghanistan. That's 37 segments in 7 weeks. For perspective, as the U.S. withdrew in August, journalists from these shows mentioned women's rights in the same sentence as Afghanistan more often, 40 times in just 7 days. Today, as those women and girls face starvation, the deeply concerned TV reporters are virtually nowhere to be seen. Even when reports did mention the crisis, they rarely highlighted the U.S. role. Of the 37 mentions, FAIR was able to find only 4 that named sanctions as a factor. MSNBC twice brought on spokespeople from the International Rescue Committee to discuss the crisis, and CBS did so once. All three of these guests named the role sanctions play in Afghanistan's economic collapse. ABC World News tonight, Ian Pannell, in a report from Afghanistan, made the only other mention of sanctions in a vague and brief reference that named no names. It said, a mix of sanctions and drought had brought the country to the brink of collapse. After showing an emaciated two-year-old and telling the child's mother, you must feel very hopeless, very helpless. Pannell wrapped up his report by noting $280 million in emergency aid has been okayed by United States and others, but it's likely not enough. It won't reach hungry mouths until the end of the year. And the situation right now in Afghanistan seems as bad as I can remember it in 20 years of reporting here, unquote. With no mention of what was causing the crisis or what kind of help was actually needed, Pannell's report had the effect of painting the U.S. as a benevolent actor that just wasn't doing quite enough to address a largely inevitable situation. The segment and its top-of-the-show preview were the only two mentions first a study found of Afghanistan's humanitarian crisis on ABC during the study period. In the Western media, more often, the crisis was covered with a brief soundbite that emphasized women's rights over the broader humanitarian crisis, as on CNN Room, which said, a group of female Afghan students graduated from a private university in Kandahar. They were forced to wear veils due to a rule imposed by the Taliban. Before the Taliban takeover, an estimated 100,000 girls were attending universities. The graduates fear finding jobs might be difficult because of both the Taliban rule and the country's worsening humanitarian crisis, unquote. Finding jobs is also difficult when a powerful enemy has frozen the funds of your nation's central bank. But that's not the kind of problem U.S. corporate media is likely to dwell on.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Desmond Tutu, South Africa's anti-apartheid icon, died on Sunday at the age of 90 after a protracted fight with prostate cancer and infections in a hospital in Cape Town. Tutu was the first Black Anglican Archbishop of South Africa. He labored relentlessly and nonviolently to bring down South Africa's brutal, decades-long apartheid dictatorship that oppressed its black majority, which ended in 1994. He was noted not just for his part in bringing an end to a dark chapter of racial discrimination in his country, but also for speaking out against injustice across the world, notably in West Asia. Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his nonviolent opposition to apartheid. A decade later, he witnessed the ends of that regime, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said Tutu's death marks another farewell to a generation that has struggled for the liberation of South Africa. He described Tutu as a man of extraordinary intellect, integrity, and invincibility against the forces of apartheid. Ramaphosa added that Tutu was also tender and vulnerable in his compassion for those who had suffered oppression, injustice and violence under apartheid, and oppressed and downtrodden people around the world.
You know, there's a number of things that leaves behind. One is that particularly during the anti-apartheid struggle, he showed and demonstrated the relevancy of black theology and African theology onto the situation, onto the context. He was able to help define the struggle, not in a way in which someone who was an oppressor would define it, but in some ways of someone who was struggling against the oppressor and against oppressive theology. I mean, he was very much a backbone of the anti-apartheid struggle. His voice was clear and clarion, and obviously he used the weight of his religious office, his ecclesiastical office, to elevate the issues around apartheid and the need to dismantle it.
Tutu was also an outspoken critic of Israeli crimes against Palestinians. He believed Palestinians have been subjected to Israel's systematic humiliation, similar to the one practiced in apartheid South Africa. Archbishop Tutu was an outspoken critic of Israeli occupation in Palestine and the siege on Gaza. He compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to the apartheid regime that discriminated against blacks in his native South Africa. Tutu led a UN fact-finding mission to investigate a November 2006 Israeli attack on Gaza's Beit Hanun district that led to the deaths of 19 Palestinians, including 7 children. In a May 2008 statement about his mission, the Archbishop decried the Israeli siege on Gaza, in place since 2007, as a gross violation of human rights. He also said the Israeli siege contradicted the Jewish and Christian scriptures, most recently in an article published in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in 2014. Desmond Tutu declared his support for the international movement of boycott, sanctions, and divestment as a peaceful means of opposing the Israeli occupation.
Well, I mean, he related what was going on in Palestine to what he had struggled against in South Africa, which was, again, apartheid, or the separation of people, or segregation, as we call it in this country, and Jim Crow in this country, apartheid there in South Africa. He saw it, he recognized that. He said basically that it was no different, and in fact, what was going on in Palestine was just as bad, if not worse, than what was going on, had gone on in South Africa. And so it was clear his eyes were eyes that were seasoned in the struggle. When I say seasoned, had gone through it, was able to recognize the dynamics of it, the violence of it, the racism in it, the white supremacy that existed in it. And he called it for what it was. That did not win him a whole lot of friends in those ranks, but because of who he was, the weight of his words and his perspective could not be denied.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu's death on Sunday sparked tributes from world leaders. Pope Francis sent his condolences, hailing his peace-building efforts. UN Chief Antonio Guterres hailed Tutu as an inspiration to generations worldwide and unwavering voice for the voiceless. The United Nations General Assembly has backed an open-ended war crimes probe against Israel, including into the regime's recent 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed at least 260 Palestinians, including over 60 children. An overwhelming majority of 125 countries voted in favor of the investigation. It was initially approved by the UN Human Rights Council in the aftermath of the Gaza War in May. The inquiry allows for a review of Israeli human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. No such open-ended investigation has ever been launched against any other UN member. The vote came after Israel's amendment to defund the probe was rejected 125-8 with 34 abstentions. Israel itself and the United States were among the few that voted against the approval of the budget for the investigation. Palestine's permanent ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, praised the vote and all the countries that rejected Israel's proposal. He thanked the UN General Assembly for approving all budgets of the programs relating to the Palestinian cause, including his request to increase funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy to the UN, who voted against the probe, said Washington will continue to oppose the investigation and to look for opportunities in Geneva to revisit its mandate. This is another example of how Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any prosecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. Speaking of vetoes, the United States has vetoed dozens of United Nations Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, including at least 53 since 1972. Washington's unequivocal support of Israel has seen it thwart resolutions condemning violence against Palestinian protesters as well as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank built since 1967. The U.S. has vetoed at least 4 UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israel's settlements on Palestinian land, which are considered illegal under international law. The U.S. support of Israel also has encouraged settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis.
Israel will prevent participation by people, by investigators. I don't think Israel will allow them into the country, whether it's this year or next year. As long as they have the backing of the United States, they continue to be able to refuse to deal with international condemnation and international investigation of the undoubted crimes that go on a daily basis against the Palestinian people.
Last week, to mark the 5th year since the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an end to all settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, issued a statement calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He stated that one statistic above all illustrates the remarkable reluctance of the international community to enforce its own directions respecting the Israeli occupation. According to his statement, when Resolution 2334 was adopted in 2016, there were an estimated 400,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and 218 in East Al-Quds. 5 years later, there are 475,000 settlers in the West Bank and 230,000 in East Al-Quds, an increase of 12%. The surge in the number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories shows how Tel Aviv ignores the 2334 resolution that states Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease.
What allows the State of Israel to ignore the UN, many UN resolutions condemning the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinians on many different fronts, what allows Israel to continue to do that is the support that it has from the United States, that it's under the umbrella of United States protection. It's almost like Israel is the 51st state of the United States, the way that it's treated by the U.S. government. And this goes through Republicans and Democrats over the years. And so what it's done is it allowed these atrocities to go on.
Concluding his statement, the UN official said only an approach based on accountability, equality, and full rights for all can create the possibility of a prosperous and shared future for Palestinians and Israelis alike. But Tel Aviv has invariably avoided all attempts at bringing it to account over its decades-long aggression against Palestinians and other regional nations, thanks to staunch support by its oldest and strongest ally, the United States.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6th when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish, or seized multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the Strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians.
Palestine will be free!
Palestine will be free! Israel, do us right!
The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian Foreign Minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's Foreign Minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent, and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach. The other parties are continuously doing interviews saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announced loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29, after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration, and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank Milli against the Deutsche Telekom. However, the decision of the European Bank is shameful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Why is there more money for the military-industrial complex? At the same time, the U.S. is refusing to spend $25 billion needed to make enough additional vaccines to vaccinate the world, asks Brett Wilkins, journalist, in an article titled, "The Pentagon Just Got $778 Billion, But USAID is running out of money for COVID-19 vaccines?" Stay tuned for more. Sharply contrasting with the $778 billion in new military spending authorized recently by President Joe Biden, the U.S. Agency for International Development reportedly can't find the funds to pay for the Biden administration's effort to help vaccinate the world population against the COVID-19, according to two agency officials interviewed by Politico. In an article published recently by the website, a pair of unnamed sources at USAID, the main government agency in charge of distributing coronavirus vaccine doses to COVAX, the Global Vaccine Equity Program, are concerned that efforts could stall in the coming spring should the administration fail to find new funding sources. According to Politico, the agency, which works with officials in the State Department, has over the past year largely relied on more than $1.6 billion allocated through the American Rescue Plan to help facilitate the shipment and administration of COVID-19 vaccine doses internationally. The agency has either used that money or already earmarked it for several months into the new year to help countries prepare to receive and distribute the doses, the official said. Without additional funding, the official said that USAID will fall behind in its commitments to help the Biden administration distribute hundreds of millions of U.S.-made doses to low- and middle-income countries by the middle of 2022. At the administration's first COVID-19 summit with foreign representatives in September, U.S. officials noted it would take at least $7 billion in 2022 to ensure shots are administered across the globe. Stephen Selmer, co-founder of Security Policy Reform Institute, a grassroots-funded think tank, tweeted recently that in 2021, Biden delivered 8% of the funding he campaigned on for physical and human infrastructure and 105% of the amount he ran for the Pentagon. Critics have noted that the $778 National Defense Authorization Act approved by Congress is $25 billion more than Biden requested, and more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. Why is there more money for the military-industrial complex, providing no additional protection for national security and arguably diminishing it? And at the same time, the U.S. is refusing to spend the $25 billion needed to make enough additional vaccines to vaccinate the world, recently asked Public Citizen President Robert Weisman earlier this month, citing the consumer advocacy group's analysis of how much it would take to inoculate humanity. According to Politico, it is unclear how USAID, which in addition to providing developmental assistance, has been accused of democracy suppression, torture, and murder, will obtain fresh funding for the U.S. vaccine distribution efforts. The two officials said the agency is exploring options, including dipping into existing pots of money used for other USAID programs. Global South leaders have regularly decried vaccine inequities, with some linking the shortfalls with ever-increasing military spending. At September's United Nations General Assembly, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez noted that 80% of doses had been distributed to middle or high-income nations, comparing that statistic to the nearly $2 trillion in global military spending, more than one-third of it by the United States regime. Asked Díaz-Canel how many lives would have been saved if those resources had been invested in health or the manufacturing and distribution of vaccines.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure household, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I would like to congratulate each and every one of you, dear brothers and sisters, and the honorable respected activists who work in the health profession on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Hazrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, and Nurses Day. This meeting is a good opportunity to speak about the defenders of health and the dear nurses. But before that, I deem it necessary to raise few points in honor of the great lady of Karbala, Hadrat Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Many discussions have been held and many complimentary remarks have been made about Zainab al-Kubra, which all have been correct. But there are two important points that may be seen in the life of the great person that I wish to discuss here. The first and foremost point is that Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, showed the great spiritual and intellectual capacity of women to all of history and to the entire world. This is very important. Despite the foolish wishes of the people to humiliate women at the time, and those who are doing so in our time, Zainab al-Kubra was able to show the highest status of women and the great psychological, mental, and spiritual strength of women. I will give a brief commentary about these points. When I said that they are humiliating women today, this is a fact. But I do not want to enter into that discussion now. More than anyone else, it is the West who is humiliating women in a dangerous way. The great person, Zainab alayhi salam, showed two points. The first point is that women can be a vast ocean of patience and endurance. And the second point is that women can be a peak of wisdom and prudence.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As the world marks International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the hermetic Israeli blockade in place since 2007. On Sunday, the Ministry of Health in Gaza announced the discovery of the first case of Omicron COVID variant in the blockaded enclave. Around 1,700 Gazans have already died because of the coronavirus since last year. The Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas, has recorded nearly 190,000 COVID-19 infections since May 2020.
We have discovered the first case of the Omicron variant in the Gaza Strip, and this indicates that this variant was now spreading among the population. The discovery poses a new challenge to the enclave's weak health system. Omicron is a fast-spreading variant and highly infectious, and will be dominant among the coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. The Israeli regime also maintains tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment, to combat COVID-19 and its variants. People in Gaza are bracing themselves for the worst following the local discovery of the Omicron variant.
The Gaza Strip's health system is fragile because of the Israeli blockade. We are afraid of Omicron because we know that it is extremely lethal. Gaza is not prepared for Omicron, and we are praying for a miracle.
The Ministry of Health in Gaza needs all the support it can get in order to combat this deadly variant. We don't have enough hospital beds or medicines because of the Israeli blockade. We call on all international organizations to help us combat the coronavirus, especially the Omicron variant.
The Israeli regime has compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for over 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health system. Experts say that the Omicron variant will only worsen the health situation in the blockaded enclave. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least 24 shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They are entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrique Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. There's 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. And therefore, Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it. Its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends. that I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us, and I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you, and I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond, and it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put,
so that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals.
I'm
not accusing anyone of lying, I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons, and I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments. Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally. A situation that has not been this bad in decades. Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. It will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims, with the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood. Perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community, seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government.